I believe that America did not conduct just the attack on Najaf, but also the attack on the UN headquarters and all the other violent acts.
This is a president who is consistently misleading the American people about what he's doing. He does so because he understands that what he's actually doing is not very popular, so he wrapped it in packaging that looks a lot better.
We get fed violence and we get tales of violence, and that starts to create an image that there's nothing we can do about it. In fact, there's a lot that we can do about it.
These weapons have been used to kill and terrorize people around the world, from Iraq to Afghanistan to Colombia.
This is Pacifica's Peace Watch for Thursday, September 18th, 2003. I'm Verna Avery Brown. U.S. troops were ambushed on the main road of Qaldiyah today in Iraq while coming under heavy gunfire. An Associated Press reporter who arrived on the scene saw two U.S. tanks surrounding a smoldering transport truck as helicopters hovered above. Taking fire from an unknown position, U.S. forces were seen firing in an apparent effort to protect themselves until reinforcements arrived. Al Arabiya Television reported 8 Americans were killed and 1 wounded. There was no confirmation, however, of any casualties, and initial casualty reports have proven incorrect in the past. The AP reporter was fired on by one of the tanks with 3 rounds from its 50-caliber machine gun. Qaldiyah is a town in the so-called Sunni Triangle in central Iraq, the heartland of support for ousted Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein and the focus of an anti-American insurgency. Yasser Arafat and leaders of his Fatah movement met today to choose ministers in the new Palestinian government, and the Palestinian leader reported progress in truth talks with Islamic militant groups. Israel has rebuffed Arafat's recent ceasefire offers, saying it will press ahead with its campaign against terror suspects until Palestinian forces begin dismantling the Hamas and Islamic Jihad groups. In the Gaza Strip, Israel staged its first major incursion in several months, killing Jihad Abu Shawara, 34, a leader of the Hamas military wing, in a shootout in the Nusrat refugee camp early today. Hundreds of soldiers were involved, an apparent signal to Hamas that Israel would not limit itself to airstrikes in Gaza. President Bush, working to find common ground with allies on a new UN-Iraq resolution, sought to dispel controversy about recent administration statements on Saddam Hussein and the September 11, 2001 terror attacks. Bush indicated the United States is not yet ready to present a revised resolution to other governments on the UN Security Council, but is trying to accommodate some allies' demands for bigger roles in Iraq's reconstruction for themselves and the United Nations. We're still talking about it, he said. President Bush conceded for the first time yesterday that the U.S. has no evidence indicating Saddam Hussein had anything to do with the September 11th terror attacks. Bush made the comment in a brief encounter with reporters at the White House, an apparent bid to answer critics who have accused him of linking the Iraq war and the terrorist attacks in order to justify an ongoing occupation which is responsible for mounting American deaths and draining an economy already mired in deficit. Bush has let the perception that Saddam Hussein was somehow involved in the attacks fester for many months, most recently in his televised address to the nation on September 7th. The Campaign for America's Future, along with activist group MoveOn.org, placed an ad in the New York Times calling Bush the misleader. PeaceWatch spoke with Robert Borsage, the co-director of the campaign, about the full-page ad, the campaign, and their website.
This ad raises the challenge that this is a president who is consistently misleading the American people about what he's doing. He does so because he understands that what he's actually doing is not very popular. So he wraps it in packaging that looks a lot better, and he misleads people. So we went back to the State of the Union address. We took his major themes, and we showed how what he said was almost directly opposite from the truth, and set up a website, misleader.org, which will reveal one misleading statement by the president every day. And we're trying to get the National Press Corps and the American people to begin to understand that this is an administration that has consistently sacrifices their trust and has huge credibility problems.
So when you say a misleading statement every day, is that just gleaned from the State of the Union address, or are you going to keep up with any statements that he's making today or next week that
it'll be daily. The State of the Union address was just the anchor. This will be all the new things as he goes about with poll-driven packaging of programs that are very unpopular. We will expose the gap between the truth and what he's saying.
So are you just going to focus on the president or his entire cabinet? Because it seems like a few of his cabinet members are suffering from this constant syndrome of selling the program.
Misleader.org will do some features on cabinet members who are particularly egregious in their lying. But the focus is going to be on the president and the president's statements.
I would imagine that the hope here is that in addition to revealing any misstatements or lies that the chief executive of this country is making, also leading up to the election campaign, is there an objective, a political objective there?
Not in this case, in the sense that what we want to do is, I think it's vital that the press stop giving this administration a pass, both in the election last time in 2000 when they pounded on Al Gore for the slightest misstatements and accepted the Republican campaign to paint Gore as somebody who was constantly lying, which simply wasn't true. And then after 9/11, essentially the press has given President Bush a pass on this kind of glaring syndrome of exaggerating or misleading people about what he's actually doing.
Your ad says that, quote, unfortunately, there's enough deception to keep such a website going. After all, a president who calls a plan to clear-cut in our national forest, the Healthy Forest Initiative, needs to be watched, end of quote. Talk about some of the other recent misstatements that you believe President Bush has made.
The most glaring, I think, was his pledge right at the top of his speech not to pass along our problems to other generations and other Congresses and other presidents, when in fact, of course, he has racked up record deficits and is in the next 5 years going to, by his own OMB, his own budget office's figures, is going to rack up $1.9 trillion of new debt that's going to be passed on to the next generation of Congress's children and presidents. The president put that statement up front, in a sense, particularly to distract attention from that reality. Similarly, we looked at the way he sold his tax cut, where he claimed that everyone who pays income taxes would get an average of almost $1,000 of their own money to keep, an average tax break of $1,000. Well, in fact, half of all taxpayers got less than $100, and about a third got nothing at all. And millionaires averaged a tax cut of $90,000. And what the president did was present one of those classic lies, damn lies, and statistics statements, where the statistics, when you average the $90,000 that 1% got and the less than 100 that 50% got, came out to about 1,000 and was totally misleading. Only this week, the president went up to one of the dirtiest power plants in the country and claimed that his clear sky legislation would help reduce the pollution from that plant. And in fact, his Clear Skies legislation will allow 100,000 more premature deaths over the next 15 years than the alternative legislation that the Environmental Protection Agency had created and that the president torpedoed.
And so what about the lies and misstatements that you believe President Bush made surrounding the most important decision that the executive chief can make, going to war?
The president tried to paint Iraq as connected to al-Qaeda and as a threat to giving its mythical weapons of mass destruction to al-Qaeda, to the terrorists, when in fact the estimate of the CIA that he had on his desk was that the only condition in which that would happen would be in the case we invaded and Saddam Hussein saw his regime being extinguished. At that point, he might give weapons to terrorists that he otherwise hated and despised. And so the president was painting a threat that only the war that he made could create. And I think it's quite clear that in place after place after place, the administration took what evidence there was and they exaggerated it, they distorted it in order to make the claim that Saddam Hussein was a threat to the United States.
Would you consider these misstatements on the part of the president deliberate attempts to deceive the American public?
Well, I think various presidents develop significant credibility problems. Lyndon Johnson developed a credibility problem over the exaggeration and lies around Vietnam. Ronald Reagan developed a significant credibility gap around the Iran-Contra revelations. So credibility gaps arise. What's stunning in this case, I believe, is that after 9/11, the country rallied around the president. And it's very clear that this administration had Iraq on its mind long before 9/11, and it quite purposely set out to mislead Americans so that now 60% of Americans believe Saddam Hussein was involved in the attack on the World Trade Centers, which was, of course, not true. That is part and parcel of a syndrome that I think is quite clear with this president that leads to a massive credibility problem, which is he's given his administration over to very conservative ideologues in foreign policy and domestic policy. And so he consistently paints his policy for something that it is not. He takes the things that are popular, we will leave no child behind in education, as a motto, and then he enforces an education policy that in fact has resulted in cuts in schools across the country. And he does it purposefully because they understand that the policies that they are enacting are in fact not popular.
Some have suggested that impeachment might be appropriate here. Would you say that these misstatements rise to the level of high crimes and misdemeanors?
I think long before we get to the impeachment question, we will get to another election, and Americans just can decide if they want to sustain this kind of leadership.
Robert Borsage, how can people sign up to receive Bush's daily misleads in their email?
You go to misleader.org, at www.misleader.org, and you can sign up there. You can also go to the Move On webpage, moveon.org, and sign up there.
Robert Borsage, the co-director of the Campaign for America's Future. Speaking on the condition of anonymity, Pentagon officials acknowledged to the New York Times yesterday that they now believe the biggest threat to the U.S. occupation of Iraq doesn't come from terrorists and gangs, as Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld has claimed, but rather from ordinary Iraqis whose anger over the American presence has turned into sympathy for those attacking U.S. troops. In one example of the festering resentment, a group of Iraqi policemen declared themselves holy warriors earlier this week and vowed to take revenge for the deaths of 10 of their fellow policemen. The men were killed by U.S. troops last Friday in what's been called the worst friendly fire incident to take place so far in the Iraq conflict. In one of the worst demonstrations of the violence and insecurity engulfing the country, a car bomb exploded last month outside the shrine of Imam Ali Najaf, Iraq, one of Shiite Islam's holiest shrines. It killed Shiite leader Ayatollah Mohammed Bakir Hakim and 80 of his fellow worshippers. It was widely regarded as the bloodiest setback since the U.S. occupation of Iraq began. The attack came at a time when Iraqis were trying to ease the tensions between their Islamic divisions. Since the attack, many protests, welcomed by the majority of Iraqis, have taken place across the country to denounce the violence, even in mainly Sunni-populated areas. Peacewatch correspondent Ahmed Al-Rawi has this report.
More than 500 kilograms of explosives were placed in a car thought to belong to Ayatollah Mohammed Bakr al-Hakim, the leader of the Supreme Council of the Islamic Revolution in Iraq. The blast on August 29th was so powerful that it left no identifiable remains of his body, except for his hand, which was identified by the ring and watch he wore. Firas Ridley was an eyewitness to the explosion.
The road was blocked after the attack. When the taxi driver told us to get out of the car, we saw people carrying some bodies and others being pushed in wheelchairs. The situation was so disgusting, I didn't want to see the sight. And the smell near the Imam Ali Mosque was awful. It reeked of blood, burnt bodies. Looking at the scene, I also saw the burned out cars and lots of smoke. It was horrible. There were people shouting and others weeping.
1 week before the attack, there was an unsuccessful assassination attempt in Najaf City against Mohammed Saeed al-Hakim. Saeed al-Hakim is the uncle of the deceased Mohammed Bakr al-Hakim, and both are highly respected among Shiite Iraqis. Perhaps even more significant than the assassination of Bakr al-Hakim, however, is the place it was conducted, say many Iraqis. The Imam Ali Mosque is the most sacred place for Shiites and Sunnis in Iraq, since its namesake was closely related to the Prophet Muhammad. In the aftermath of the attacks, many Iraqis are placing the blame upon members of the Wahhabi sect of Islam, of Saudi Arabia, or members of Al-Qaeda. According to Al Jazeera television, however, Al-Qaeda has delivered a recorded tape denying responsibility. pointed the finger instead at Israel and America, claiming they would be the only ones to benefit from raising tensions between Sunnis and Shiites. Sheikh Faris al-Ibrahimi is a student and a teacher at Al-Hakim Religious School in Najaf City. He criticizes the United States for what he perceives as its passive role in the latest attack.
What did America give to the Iraqi people? When they first entered the country, they encouraged the looting. If only they had shot one bullet into the sky, nothing would have ever happened. Our religious men are threatened. Our religious references are threatened. Bombs are thrown at them without the Americans moving one step. Couldn't the Americans have stopped this latest attack that happened near the Holy Mosque and killed the martyr Muhammad Bakir al-Hakim? Couldn't the Americans stop this attack? They prevented the Iraqi people from preserving security. Several times, the martyr proposed to the Americans to form an Iraqi security force, since Iraqis can distinguish between the enemy and the friend, the good and the bad. Muhammad Bakir al-Hakim said that the Americans cannot restore security because they only have tanks.
Al-Hakim had several enemies. The oldest and most notorious was Saddam Hussein, who Al-Hakim resisted during his 23-year stay in Iran. But after the assassination, Hussein sent a recorded tape to Arab satellite channels denying his role in the attack. Other enemies of Al-Hakim come from various Shiite divisions, like Muqtada Sadr and some members of the Shiite group of Hawz al-Ilmiyya. There are allegations that many Iraqi prisoners of war detained in Iran were maltreated by Al-Hakim. Nevertheless, some Iraqis still believe that the United States is the initiator of the attack, since Al-Hakim was allied with Iran, which President Bush considered a hostile enemy and a member of the so-called Axis of Evil. Among the Iraqis who are pointing the finger at the U.S. is Huda Muhammad from the Shiite city of Kazimiya.
America blames the Baathists or the followers of bin Laden, or the Arabs, or the Sunnis. There's no solid proof against America in this attack. But the attack will benefit America greatly, since it will prolong the duration of its occupation of Iraq. Its aim is to make no one interfere in its affairs and interests in this country. I believe that America did not conduct just the attack on Najaf, but also the attack on the UN headquarters and all the other violent acts. Why did these violent acts increase after the appearance of a strong resistance against American soldiers? Why do we hear of a series of attacks? Why? They intend to make the Iraqi people fight against each other, making humanitarian organizations leave Iraq. So the U.S. is the only authority left in charge.
Iraqi Shiites are now waiting for the results of the investigations into last month's bombing. Many Iraqis say they are unsatisfied with the U.S. apparent inability so far to provide security and order to their country. As attacks and assassinations, such as what happened to Ayatollah Muhammad Baqir al-Hakim, continue to occur under the watch of American soldiers, Iraqi anger and contempt towards the American administration continues to rise. For Pacificus Peace Watch, this is Ahmed Arawi in Baghdad.
The Air Force Association, a private professional association not officially linked to the Defense Department, held its annual National Convention and Aerospace Technology Expo at a hotel in Washington, D.C. this week. Representatives of militaries and corporations from around the globe met to celebrate 100 years of powered flight and to honor their own achievements while promoting the latest weapons and supporting technologies for war. But according to several anti-war activists holding vigil outside, it was nothing more than a high-tech, glamorous arms bazaar. Peace Watch correspondent Matthew Bradley attended the events and brings us this report.
In the affluent upper northwest Washington, D.C. neighborhood of Woodley Park, nestled away in the large halls of the Marriott, was a gathering of Air Force officers from around the world. Among those attending the exposition held by the Air Force Association that ended on Wednesday were representatives from Cambodia, South Africa, Sweden, India, Pakistan, Jordan, Kenya, Botswana, and a number of South American countries, not to mention the hundreds of U.S. Air Force officers, service persons, and young cadets. On the show floor, the the logos of over 100 top weapons makers hovered over extravagant booths with scaled-down and full-size models of various weaponry and technology demonstrations of surveillance and information products from many recognizable brands. GE aircraft engines, Lockheed Martin jet fighters, Raytheon missiles and guidance systems, Saab jets, and Ericsson radars. Few of these booths were equipped to speak to the press. Their occupants weren't authorized, or their press officer was out. At the Boeing booth, Bruce, who is in business development and isn't a press officer, wouldn't give me his last name, but had sympathy for me and ran me through a demo of their latest network-centric information-based battle simulator. The flashy graphics and 3D animations, he admitted, were mostly for show, but they represented the real live demos and wartime applications.
A radar sight, and then some launchers. So we're going to do a coordinated attack. We're going to use an EA-18 to a flight of EA-18s to neutralize the radar sight, firing HARM missiles at it. It's home in on the radar, and then after they're neutralized, we'll go ahead and use the UCAV, unmanned combat air vehicle, to drop JDAM precision weapon to take out the actual launchers. And then the Global Hawk that did the targeting for us now, we'll go ahead and do a battle damage assessment. And as that information on... What is going on with this thing? As that information is...
I'm going to get out of this.
Okay. Anyhow, you get enough.
This was his second try. The first scenario also ended in a technical glitch. We moved from virtual reality to conversation. I asked him, was technology like what he had just shown me deployed in Iraq?
You know, it's an evolutionary thing. It's fair to say that we did. There were major strides made in the Iraqi conflict as far as being more network-centric. You've heard the story about the special ops guy on the camel or the horse that was out there and had a laser designator and did close air support with the B-52 aircraft, which is completely non-traditional use. All right, so that's one example of how we use the network-centric and use weapon systems in a less than traditional ways by sharing information.
While few of the product vendors would speak to me on the record about what exactly they were selling and who might be buying it, I had more success with those advertising services. Albert D. Zuniga, with the U.S. Air Force-run Inter-American Air Forces Academy, was happy to share what the Academy had to offer. Although he seemed to cringe when I suggested it might be compared to a Fort Benning, but for the Air Force, I let him explain how it worked.
Again, this is the Inter-American Air Forces Academy. We're out of Lackland Air Force Base, San Antonio, and we are celebrating our 60-year anniversary, 60 years of service since 1943. And the Academy originated in 1943, again, in Panama. We provide training to the Latin American countries, Central and South America. It's over about 20 countries that we take care of, participants, 800 to 900 students a year. Average class about 300, 200 students. We take students from Army, Navy, Air Force, Coast Guard, and some countries in South America, Latin South America, they don't have armed forces. They have a national police. So we take those also. We have seven trainers. We have the old A-37 fighter and the C-130 aircraft. We have an F-5. We have about four helicopter trainers, which is our most popular course. So we'll get a active duty helicopter instructor from the field, and we'll throw a whole bunch of Huey, which is what we offer. A lot of the armed forces they use in Latin America. They use a helicopter. C-130 is a popular course also, but it's interoperability. You can see the amount of uniforms, different uniforms. From different countries. This is the Americas, they're our neighbors, so they learn to work not only together with us, with the United States, but within their own countries. The Inter-Americanism is what the end item, the end goal is of the Academy. Certain countries that have border disputes for whatever reason, when they work together at the Academy, they go back to their countries and they get to be in a position of decision-making or those types. They'll remember that the Academy pushed Inter-Americanism and that ideal, and they'll be able to work together. So whenever we do our interoperability, Iraq, for example.
In the progress of this conversation, Zuniga also shared with me that he has had a hard time recruiting new instructors from the Air Force to support the growing ranks of students. Most people in the U.S. Air Force, he says, don't even know about the academy.
These weapons have been used to kill and terrorize people around the world, from Iraq to Afghanistan to Colombia.
Outside that evening, scores gathered for a candlelight vigil sponsored by the Dorothy Day Catholic Workers. They demonstrated peacefully by the driveway where the attendees of the exposition and conference were driving to attend a ball, priced at over $200 a plate. The activists said that this expo was an example of the disparity in resources spent on war, rather than reinforcing supportive mechanisms of society for all people.
This idolatry of weapons and glorification of war must cease. As the U.S. pursues its quest for empire and its control over the Earth's resources, especially oil, the rich get richer and the poor get poorer. While the U.S. military and weapons contractors seek to militarize space, launch new warships, and build a new generation of nuclear weapons, over 40 million U.S. citizens lack health insurance. Vitally needed social services are being cut. Dorothy Day put it this way: the only solution is love.
I'm Judith Kelly from Arlington. I do nonviolence training with the Pache Ibene Nonviolence Service. And I just completed 3 months at Alderson, West Virginia, for nonviolent civil disobedience at Fort Benning with my friend Laura Slattery, West Point graduate. One of my friends in Bellingham, Washington, was talking about the SOA and how it trains promising young leaders in Latin America and brings them to Georgia and wines and dines them, gets them to think about America in a positive way. And, you know, when it comes to buying weapons, what kind of weapons do you think they'll buy? American-made. And relying on military solutions is what we're trying to inform people about, that it doesn't work and it will never work.
Down by the riverside, I'm going to lay down my sword and shield. Down by the riverside, ain't going to study war no more, no war, no more.
In Washington, D.C., for Peace Watch, this is Matt Bradley.
You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. We'll be back in a moment.
I'm gonna go to